Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. I'm producer Caleb, and today I'm joined by Dr. Rod Rosenblatt, Dr. Adam Francisco, and swapping in for Dr. Keith, who is still out ill, is Kurt Winrich. If you haven't already listened to the episode that will have gone up before this one, where Kurt was our guest and kind of our head speaker on addressing apologetics to youth, to young adults, little correct my language there. And so that was a fun episode. If you haven't listened to it, I encourage you to go listen to it before coming into this one, or you could skip it, but I think you'd be skipping a gem of resources if you did so. Today we're going to talk about, is there any evidence for miracles? Are miracles historically reliable? Can they be trusted? But before we hop into that primary topic today, I just had a couple announcements. As you know, this show is run by 1517, the Legacy Project. 1517 is a nonprofit organization whose goal is to help people who have been broken by the church or are struggling within the church, a church that has beaten them over the head with morals and removed kind of the gospel from their lives. And so what 1517 does is produce apologetics and evangelism resources and push those out to the masses via some online tools such as blogs and podcasts like the one you're listening to right now. But we also have a speakers bureau that goes out to congregations and various groups to go talk about apologetics, evangelism, church history, and the like. And so that organization sponsors 1517, or sponsors the Thinking Fellows. And how that works is through donations like listeners like yourselves. And so if you feel so inclined to support the show, to support the outreach that is going on here, please go to thinkingfellows.com and hit the big donate button at the top right of the page there. And if you hit that, you'll be directed to a screen that shows a little form. And the form's really simple. You just put your name, your email address, credit card / debit card information there. If you want to, you can add a note. And those donations go directly through 1517 to the Thinking Fellows podcast so that we can use those funds to improve equipment, get guests on the show. We can fly guests out. We can fly out to certain venues for events and guests like that. We can improve aspects of the show. A couple weeks ago, I talked about funding some equipment that we broke in Germany so that we needed. And so we thank current donors to the show right now. We have a couple people who donate, who have it set up, reoccurring donations every month to the show, and we are extremely thankful for that. And so if you haven't already, please go check out what's going on over at 1517 and see if this is a cause you find worthwhile. All right, so let's jump in to today's topic. Is there any evidence for miracles? This is kind of stemming out of the topics that we had done in our regular series before we took that break last week, where we talked about the validity of the New Testament texts. Can the New Testament documents be trusted? And then we talked about the claims of Christ. Can the words of Christ, the things he claimed to be able to do, be true? And a lot of what he claimed to be able to do or what the texts claim about him is miraculous. And so today we're going to kind of talk about how that plays into it. So Rod, I was thinking, could you kind of introduce the issues surrounding this? Why do miracles come into question, into play here, and why are they important to be able to defend?
Well, as any student can tell you, if they've just been in an intro to philosophy class, the classic is David Hume, and it's short. And it's worth reading as a really bad argument. There's been a book written on Mr. Hume's horrible argument by another philosopher just within the last decade. So that's your first source because it has survived and survived and survived and survived. Now, one of the phrases you'll hear Dr. Montgomery using again and again and again is one that you don't, on first hearing, realize how loaded it is. He speaks of true empirical method. Now, why is that so important? Well, think of the historians who will say, and they do, any miracle account has to be ruled out of our field before they even begin. Now, somebody from the hard sciences knows that that is a very unusual thing to say. I'll give you an example. A group called the Logical Positivists, hardcore unbelievers, good thinkers, dealt with the question, is geology, not repeatable, science? And they had a hell of a row over that one. And begrudgingly, at the end of the argument, they said, yes, it qualifies. Now, if repeatability is not the linchpin on which this turns, then the field is open to historical as well, which is non-repeatable. The question is, if the evidence is strong for something miraculous occurring, you stay with it. You follow the evidence no matter what. Now, you say, well, good grief, that would open it up to the Loch Ness Monster and the Yeti and God knows what. Answer, yes.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, it does. But you can't a priori rule these things out because you're an historian. If the evidence leads you there, then at least you've got to say, my, that's unusual, or something like that, highly unusual. But you can't rule it out a priori. So the key thing is, if miracles did occur, could you document the evidence for them? And if you can, then don't you think you ought to reject ruling them out?
Right.
In other words, it's doing the thing backwards. Now, those in the hard sciences recognize this in a minute. Historians, sociologists, psych people in the soft sciences can't seem to see that. But I would say that it's Hume and whether you can find solid evidence that something very, 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 very unusual happened. Are you going to be on the side of dead people stay dead, or are you going to say, well, if they don't all stay dead, that's surprising to me?
Yeah.
The one matches with hard empirical science, the other doesn't. Does that help?
It does. And I think one of the things that you touch on here is just because you have to be open to the possibility of them at the beginning doesn't mean that even if you come up, you have to follow that trail, that they're normal when they do happen, right? That's why they get the name miracle.
Yeah, right.
It's not like they happen every day.
Right.
This isn't something that you should be non-surprised about, right? When they do happen, it should be, wow, this happened.
Yeah.
This is crazy. And so I think that's something that we don't need to come across them as normal.
Now, another thing I ought to mention right at the beginning, if you're in a bookstore that still carries books, and you see the combination C.S. Lewis and the word miracle, he wrote a book on miracles, know beforehand that this is going to be rough going because he's going to take on David Hume's bad argument.
Yeah.
But don't think you'll read it while the television's going on in the background. This is really tough sledding. Lewis, if anybody, can make something simple for the rest of us in a way that most authors can't. But know beforehand, if you just happen to run across that book and you buy it, know that it's going to be tough sledding. Now, it's another one where we've got some good outlines of the book itself, and that'll be available on 1517 for cheap. But know that.
Yeah.
Just know that.
Taking on Hume, even so he's writing 1770s, almost 300 years, over 200 years later, is still of the essence. The Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy says that he left an indelible mark.
Yep.
Even on biblical studies.
Yep.
Yeah.
So he's still influential. You see it in the works of Bart Ehrman.
Yep.
An essay I might add to Lewis's book on miracles is Dr. Montgomery's essay. I think it's entitled Science, Theology, and the Miraculous.
It is.
In the book Faith Founded on Fact.
Yep.
20 pages, And when you sit down to read that, you got to strap yourself in because it's quite a ride. But it's one of those essays that you had me read 20 years ago or however long ago it was that just sort of shaped the way, not just the way I think about miracles and history, but my basic methodology in approaching what is true and what has happened in the past and so on. It's tremendously influential.
Yeah.
And a tour de force
yeah.
in taking on Hume from a late 20th century perspective.
Yeah.
Great. So if we were going to try to sum up, now you mentioned Hume's bad argument, right? Yeah. How would we sum up that argument for the readers who don't have time to, or may have not, are not formally aware of Hume's argument?
What he ends up saying is no evidence can count in favor of miracles. No evidence can count. And, you know, it's just like from a pulpit. Now, he thinks that he has done that work so that he can say that at the end, but that's what it amounts to. No amount of evidence could justify believing in one. Mm. None.
Yeah. There's firm and unalterable experience
that's
against
the phrase.
It, right?
Mm-hmm. The inquiry concerning human understanding, there is firm and unalterable evidence. Now, what he does is kind of tricky, and I won't spend any time on this. Mm-hmm. What it really is that the first part of the sentence is repeated in the second part of the sentence. What logicians call a tautology.
Yeah.
He just uses different words, but they're the equivalent.
Yeah.
That's why the philosophers go after him if it's not too holy to go after.
Mm-hmm. Great. So I think one of the things that I'd like to chase down here is that Hume kind of goes after a natural law argument,
yes.
right, here. And this is the typical argument that we're still going to hear against this,
yep.
right? Miracles are not a part of nature.
Yep.
We don't observe them. We don't see them. This is the same type of argument that I think is often used against things like the spirit or the soul, ghosts, things like that, mm-hmm. things that Christians might even use when it comes to supernatural events outside of Scripture and things like that. And that's kind of infiltrated thinking as a whole
sure.
in the Western world today. I think it's even infiltrated the hard sciences in a lot of ways.
Oh, good Lord,
right?
Deliver.
As the presupposition of the hard sciences is that we can only deal with what's observable, what's natural,
right.
Which, as you say, is a huge problem for their field.
Yeah.
And so if there's natural laws against miracles, where do these laws come from? Where do we get this?
What I'd recommend is that we never, never acknowledge a definition of them as breaking natural law.
Mm-hmm.
You say, well, then what would you substitute? I would substitute very, very, very highly unusual events that have high existential import. You say, well, that's kind of slippery. No. We're thinking on a spectrum of what usually happens all the way to what almost never happens. But it's a spectrum. And I want to stick on that spectrum rather than bring in firm, knowable natural law. Why? Because scientists know that what we call natural law, or even laws of science, the highest level you can get to, are still generalizations from observations. There have just been a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They're descriptions, not prescriptions.
That's right. I say to my students, if I came in here and said, what do you make of the germ theory of disease? You'd go ask for your money back, and you should, for the course. Or what if I said to you, what do you make of the theory that blood circulates through the body? You would say, I'm getting out of here and getting my money back. And you should. Why? Because that's a use of theory that is so countermanded by a zillion instantiations that it's weird for me to call it a theory.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm? We're on that same spectrum again with the question of miracle. Normal, everyday, what we walk around in every single day, all the way to almost never. But I'm saying, if you leave out the natural law definition and have a little slipperier definition, you can still work on that spectrum. They're highly, highly unusual events, usually that have high existential import. And I can put the resurrection right there, resurrection of Christ, and want to. I don't want to rule it out by some definition that can't include it. And I think that's the route the hard scientists should go. I've had hard scientists say to me, you're the first one that's given me a rationale as a Christian that I can actually use with my coworkers. Mm-hmm. 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 Because it's objective, not subjective. Anyway, for what it's worth.
As you guys are talking about this, I think back to something I first heard from John Lennox, who's an Oxford mathematician who's also an apologist. And he undoubtedly got this from Lewis. I think he actually knew Lewis back in the day. Mm-hmm. And I found a thing on the web about a quote from Lewis's Miracles book that connects to this. In the introduction here, it says, the danger we're facing here is a confusion between the legal use of the word law and the scientific use of the word law, which is what you just got through saying. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's inaccurate or misleading to say that miracles violate the laws of nature.
Yeah.
It is rather that God feeds new events into the system from time to time.
Right.
And that's where, here's the quote from Lewis, if God annihilates or creates or deflects a unit of matter, he has created a new situation at that point. Immediately, all nature domiciles this new situation, makes it at home in her realm, adapts all other events to it. It finds itself conforming to all the laws. If God creates a miraculous spermatozoan in the body of a virgin, it does not proceed to break any laws. The laws at once take over. Nature is ready, pregnancy follows according to all the normal laws, and 9 months later a child is born. That's Lewis Miracles, page 63. Mm-hmm. The story that Lennox used to tell that drove this home for me that I thought was pretty funny is that he's talking about staying in the States and being in a hotel, and he put a $20 bill in the nightstand drawer, and in the morning he woke up and the $20 bill is gone. And so he said, that may have violated the laws of the state of California, but it didn't violate the laws of nature. Somebody came along and took that. You know, there was new injection of information. Mm. And so that's one of the ways he talks about miracles and not thinking of them as a violation of the laws of nature.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Great. I think this is a point where we can, we've now kind of tackled the basics of Hume's argument. So we're going to go ahead and take our break here, and then when we come back, we'll be able to kind of present the counter to Hume's argument and some of the positive evidences for miracles. Hey, welcome to our break. Today we're going to talk about a book that Dr. Francisco mentioned glancingly. He talked about an essay in there. And that book is Faith Founded on Fact. It's by Dr. John Montgomery. And it is on the 1517 Legacy Shop. And since Adam mentioned it before, I thought it'd be appropriate to have him say a couple things about the book, maybe what kind of essays you can find in there.
Yeah, well, the book has a collection of some of his more I don't know if significant is the right word, but his more focused essays on topics like the problem of miracles. There's a chapter and that's of particular interest to me because it's my little neck of the woods, entitled something like "How Muslims Do Apologetics," which is an old journal article
in the Muslim world.
Yeah, which is there's an interesting history to that journal. It was put together out of Hartford Seminary, Connecticut, as sort of the journal for Christians going off to the Muslim world to engage in missionary endeavors. Most recently, last 10 years, that journal has a complete Muslim editorial committee. It's done by the Duncan MacDonald School of Islamic Studies that's been completely taken over by Muslims. My former doctoral supervisor is the editor for the journal and one of the chief guys there. It's kind of interesting. But the essay is on, it's a great essay for understanding, just generally speaking, how Muslims have typically approached apologetics. It's basically, they use what we might call a presuppositionalist methodology. It's a great little introduction to that. The chapter we talked about earlier before the break is entitled Science, Theology, and the Miraculous. I have before me an outline of that chapter, And it looks like I did it back in 2000, so 16 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I'm looking at it going, wow, that really is a pretty rigorous chapter.
It is. It is.
And if memory serves me correctly, and looking at this 8-page outline, what he especially does in that chapter is goes after defining what a miracle is, what we just talked about.
Yes.
It's not, we ought not, he argues, define it as a violation of the laws of nature. It's a non-analogous event that has deep existential meaning.
Uh-huh.
If you define it as a violation of the laws of nature, you run into all sorts of problems. And he illustrates from Antony Flew to a whole variety of other philosophers how that is the case. From the overall chapter, what's really interesting is a point he makes towards the end that the Christian apologist demonstrates the veracity of Christianity using empirical methodology.
Yep.
And he says in doing so that we're simply using reasoning the way a scientist reasons.
Yep.
He says towards the end, the more willing we are to allow empirical evidence of the unique and non-analogous to stand, the better not just apologists we are, but the better scientists and philosophers we become. The more willing that Christians are to employ the biblical and classical apologetic from miracle, the more effectively we can give a reason for the hope that is within us.
For those who are in the sciences, read it just to see his use of the periodic table of the elements. It's toward the end, too. The standard is the inert gases don't combine because they're not interested in combining. And then some Wheaton students decided to try it, and they made it work. You have to go with the particular, regardless of the general that you think is just solid as a rock.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The particular overrides that.
Yeah, that was, for me, in the whole book, and just Montgomery's, if you will, his philosophy or epistemology, that is his greatest strength, is that he is always going after what does the evidence say,
mm-hmm.
and insists on sticking with that in every particular. So much so that he's open to, you know, that he wrote, I think, 2 books on the occult,
mm-hmm.
Principalities and Powers, and one other, I can't remember, where he's looking at bizarre claims, and he's saying, listen, we've got to be open to this, and what's going to govern how we decide on these particular matters is where the evidence stacks up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For instance, when The Exorcist 1, mm-hmm. the first one came out, he put out a trifold brochure. The front of it was a priest carrying a bag underneath a streetlight, which was like a scene from the movie. And the title of it was, to help you to understand the movie you're about to watch. And they went out by the gajillions. Evangelicals passed them out to people standing in line at the theaters. He was going to use an account like that to say, don't believe anybody who tells you that such things are silly or unthinkable. Yeah.
That's right, yeah. There is another chapter that just came to mind from the book Faith Founded on Fact that's worth reading. We've talked about apologetic methodology in the past, and we talked briefly about presuppositionalism. And if you want a really fun critique of presuppositionalism, it's the chapter entitled Once Upon an A Priori, which Dr. Rosenblatt told me in the break was actually originally in a Festschrift for Cornelius Van Til.
It was.
So I don't know if there's anything to add about that, but I do remember reading it. Just it's kind of strange at first because it's all make-believe, but it illustrates the problem of reasoning from an a priori, from an assumption or presumption.
Yeah, what the presuppositionalist says is just assume the thing is true and then see if your world doesn't cohere better once you've assumed the whole thing is true. Well, that first step for somebody who's an unbeliever to just assume the whole thing is true is unthinkable.
Mm, yeah.
He's looking to you to give an argument for your side.
Yeah. There's also a chapter in the book on the Lutheranism and the defense of the Christian faith. Am I right? That was they were originally his lectures at Bethany Lutheran College,
Mankato.
The Reformation lectures.
Yep.
And that, for our Lutheran listeners, is absolutely worth reading if you have any sort of objection to apologetics from a Lutheran theological standpoint. Yep. He goes through not just the Lutheran theology generally and how it's open to an empirical approach to apologetics, but then he goes through what's real strong for the real confessional crowd is he goes through the classic Lutheran dogmaticians from Chemnitz to all the way to Beyer through John Gerhard in the middle and gives you page number, line number to every little discussion on apologetics in those works, showing or showcasing where these are basically they're approaching apologetics in an inductive manner.
Yeah.
So that's definitely worth the read.
Yeah, for the ones who are come out of our seminaries, that can be axis changing.
Mm.
Is that the little piece called The Place of Reason in Christian Witness? Is that the one you're referring to?
That one was written as a response to a letter he got after History and Christianity was published. So that's not exactly the same. But it sure is interesting because it invited him to give a rationale for.
Right.
Yeah, I see you have the... Do you have the table of contents? I probably should have done that.
Yeah. So that book is Faith Founded on Fact, Essays and Evidential Apologetics. It can be found on the 1517 Legacy website at shop.1517legacy.com. And, of course, I will have a direct link in the show notes to the page there where you can buy it. It's reasonably priced. It's $17.95, and you're not getting a small book for $17.95. Mm-hmm. That's one of the thicker ones there offered. It's a great book, though. Okay, so let's move back into our topic. Before we got to our break, we talked about the bad argument of Hume and kind of how his bad epistemology had entered into philosophical reasoning. And Dr. Francisco and I were talking during our little break, off-air break there, he wants to kind of go into some of the problems this poses historically and why and some of the counters to this, why we can't buy into this logic.
Yeah, well, one of the big problems with Hume's reasoning is while epistemologically his epistemology, his empirical epistemology seems sound, there's something that's smuggled into his argument, and that's a presupposition of what we might call today a naturalistic presupposition.
Yes.
That only that which is natural, defined as natural, is open to any sort of inquiry. So he's ruled out a priori. He doesn't have a sentence that says this, but if you look at the argument closely, and this is Lewis's point in his book on miracles, he assumes that only the natural world is investigatable. Miracles, by definition, are supernatural, if we have to find it that way. So they are... Ruled out a priori. You're not even to look into them. And while there are apologists for Hume's methodology... people have worked on it even to this day who have kind of...
Flew was an expert in Hume's studies.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, I mean, we've mentioned his name before here, and I'll pick on him again. Bart Ehrman has taken Hume's argument and put it right in the middle of a work that is probably the most widely used introduction to the New Testament in universities today. The way he puts the argument, it is in a syllogistic format, you could say the first premise is a miracle is by definition the most improbable of events. The probability of a miracle is infinitesimally remote. Second premise, a historian can establish only what probably happened in the past. Therefore, an historian can never establish that a miracle happened.
Yep.
Mm. I wrote a little chapter on Hume's or Ehrman's argument. And he does the same thing Hume does. Mm-hmm. Miracles are supernatural events. Historians only have access to natural events. Therefore, you can never make the claim that a miracle happened. What Ehrman does to kind of save his skin in this excursus in the book is he argues that miracles certainly can happen. It's just that a historian can't get to them. And what's working at in the background is again this naturalistic philosophy. The way it's colored is that they're using a naturalistic epistemology.
That's right.
But there's always what philosophers might call an ontology or metaphysic that's attached to it. Or not, maybe not always, but in this case it is. So while it looks like they're using proper empirical methodology, they're assuming something, a larger picture of what is possible, what's not, and so on. Moreover, if the argument...
And you end up in the strange position, at least with regard to the Christian faith, that something happened in this world that somebody who's a historian can't examine.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of a beastie is that?
It's almost like turning Karl Barth on his head. Mm-hmm. You know, Barth argued that the resurrection was in the realm of what?
Meta-history.
Meta-history. Right? And he's doing that to protect Christianity from scrutiny, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
But nobody has access to it unless you have the eyes of faith, so to speak. Whereas Ehrman, the other... that crowd are saying something similar but directly opposite in that Ehrman will say miracles can and perhaps have happened in quite a bit, he says, but there's no way we can talk about it.
Yep.
And what he's kind of done, though I don't know that he's trained in any sort of analytic philosophy, he's kind of he's argued that the claim that Jesus rose from the dead lies in the realm of the nonsensical or the meaningless. Another question I have of Ehrman also is when he says that a miracle is by definition the most improbable events, the probability of a miracle is infinitesimally remote. Well, who's he to say what's possible, probable, and so on and so forth? That's all determined from a historian's perspective by the evidence.
Sure.
You don't start off a priori by defining something like a miracle as improbable or almost
infinitely improbable.
That's, you have no access to that information. What determines what's probable historically is the weight of the evidence.
Sure.
And that's it.
Sure.
Any other things added to it are you're forcing a metaphysic or an assumption about the way the world works and operates into that inquiry, and it breaks empirical methodology.
Yep.
Yeah, it's not empirical itself. It's this supernatural presupposition that they have the world that they claim is natural somehow. Very strange. So when we are approaching this kind of at a lay level, right? People who are coming into our churches, perhaps asking us questions like this, maybe they even question the necessity of miracles. I've heard sometimes, why do we have to include these? Just say that these didn't happen.
In the book of Acts, in the earliest writings, the defense of the gospel is true to Jews was from fulfilled messianic prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
To Gentiles, it was miracle. In other words, if you want to be in line with the earliest proclamation of Christianity, this is how they did it. Mm. That's not a bad recommend.
Mm. Right. Now, doesn't the Gospel of John tells us that he did these signs so that we might believe, right?
That's right. That's what he said, semeion.
Yeah, so that connects to your question, Caleb, right? That why do we need to talk about these? They're actually given to us. You can think of them as gifts in a way.
Yeah. He pointed that way. Mm-hmm. If you do not believe my words, believe me for the sake of the works that I do. They bear witness of me.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally he let out that he was going to die and rise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's where, if you want to overturn Christianity, here's where to overturn it.
Mm. Yeah, but be careful, as Kurt said earlier. People who tend to, who try to disprove it end up
believing
it in the long run.
Yeah.
Let's encourage that.
I think that was, wasn't that the case with the author of Ben-Hur?
I believe it was. I've heard that story too.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to remember if Jim Caviezel was that way. Was he a believer actually before he did The Passion, or did he become a believer during it? One of those. But it has a way of doing that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I remember my young son, when we went to see Ben-Hur, when he was just young, was just transfixed with Christ carrying the cross and somebody giving him a cup of water on the way. And he was just transfixed with that scene. Somebody got it. Huh. Somebody came there and offered him water on the way.
So I think the big takeaways here are that miracles are something that Christians don't need to be afraid of, number one, right? There's something that indeed talk about.
You qualify that. I'm not talking about crying statues.
Right. That's right. We're talking about the talking recorded about, miracles of
yeah,
the New
I'm
Testament.
I'm talking about those.
Yes. Right. So, and that I think that is a good qualifier for our listeners, right? We're not talking about any old miracles here. We're not talking about me walking out to the street and going healing somebody right now.
No, not primarily.
Yeah, we're talking about the things that have been recorded for us that we know historically.
Yep.
I think one of the other big things here is that I hear commonly that this is one of the reasons that people will call the New Testament a fairy tale story and things like that. Mm-hmm. Oh, it all seems on the up and up until you get to miracles or something like mm-hmm. that. And that's just not the case, right? We've seen here that miracles are part of this historical record that's been proven time and time again that we've shown on the last couple of episodes. If you missed those episodes about the reliability of the New Testament documents, this is so bundled up in that, right? Because this does not leave that historical method. This stays within that method. So when you're looking at the evidences for these miracles, you're still looking at the evidence for the texts, the claim of Christ, the validity of who are the sure. authors here and things like that.
Sure. Those things the historians claim they can evaluate.
That's right.
It's just that most of them a priori rule out any miracle story, whatever. Well, that vitiates a goodly amount of the Gospels. Ruling it out a priori.
Yeah, and that's not a necessary part of doing history or
no.
science or something like that. And if
no.
somebody tells you that, they're using very poor logic mm-hmm. At the end of the day. Is there anything that you guys think we've missed that we've covered before we wrap up the episode?
Well, I would just say that the case is a good one. Try it out.
Mm-hmm.
See what you think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I think thinking just as historically or historiographically, if you look at the case for the resurrection, there is no other conclusion you can draw to explain the empty tomb but for the resurrection.
Yeah. And
to be sure, people have come up with all sorts of theories like the swoon theory and mass hallucinations and so on and so forth. But all the alternative explanations, they do not account for all the evidence we have.
Mm-hmm.
They might pull on one piece of evidence, but they don't account for all. So I would... I'm thinking, I'm a historian by profession. I have no hesitation to say that all the evidence lies in favor of the resurrection. There's no other counter evidence that would discredit it. So Christians can be certainly confident, apologetically speaking.
I forget whether it was Regnan or Strauss who, when he saw the swoon theory, said, "This is absolutely silly."
They all, if you read, think of the most recent stuff, Dan Brown and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
They're all conspiracy theories, really.
Yep.
If you look at them, there's no way you can falsify these things.
Uh-huh.
They take up pieces of evidence and plug it into a theory. So it sounds, and everybody loves a good conspiracy theory, Dan
mm-hmm.
Brown
yeah.
says. So they sound nice,
sure.
but it's evidence put into a theory. It's not a theory, so to speak, that's taken from the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way they all work.
Big point.
Mm. Yeah, that is big.
You guys are talking about, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, you're talking about abductive reasoning here, the inference to best explanation idea,
mm-hmm.
where you take, and we actually chatted about this earlier today, Adam, the idea that there are certain facts that need to be explained about Christ's resurrection,
mm-hmm.
empty tomb, appearances, all those things. And what we're looking for is the simplest, most likely explanation
yes.
that mm-hmm. covers all the bases,
mm-hmm.
offers the most explanatory power.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, you mentioned the Dan Browns. They do get us all excited because it's like, oh, I never thought of that. But when you stop for a minute and you go, that's more incredible to think
yeah.
that happened
yeah.
than the miracle we're trying
yeah.
to understand.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
right.
Yeah. yeah.
So it's not the simplest and most likely explanation. And the one that you've written about in your book, for example, that you just summarized, that's the one that has the most explanatory power.
Yeah.
And that book that you're referring to there is Resurrection Fact.
Mm-hmm.
And that is available if you haven't been listening to previous shows before. 1534. That's available at shop.1517legacy.com. That should be available well before this episode came out. A couple weeks before this episode will come out. And so if you haven't already gotten a copy of that book, I think that book is just an absolute must-have on your bookshelf. It's something that you can follow along with on the show here, and we'll definitely add to the conversation. Mm-hmm. All right, guys, thanks for listening. If you haven't already, please go subscribe to the show on your favorite podcasting app. For a lot of people, that's iTunes. And while you're there, if you could please drop us a rating, 5 stars is always appreciated. We will catch you next time.